following material was performed under extreme mental duress and lack of prescribed medication.
You know, there's a lot more to comedy than what you see on a stage.
I like the idea of comedy at night.
I looked in the contract and said there may be gunplay.
Band members there, the strippers half naked sitting on the thing, everyone there is smoking pot.
Rule number one, attack the audience verbally.
I'm not normal. She should have warned you.
I emptied my case. They didn't boo me or anything. It's just every time I came out from behind the case, another 10 people had left. And man, I was ready to hang myself. I'm not kidding, man. I measured the light cord in the room and everything.
From Wits End Comedy Club in Westminster, Colorado, it's The Green Room. A chance for you to meet the comedians coming into Wits End, and a place where we talk about all things comedy, both on and off the stage.
Hey, everybody, you have made it once again. It's The Green Room. Thank you very much for listening. So let's go through this logically. If this is The Green Room, then I must be Vilmos, because lately I haven't been getting much sleep, and I'm not sure about all of these things. But I am certainly sure that I'm glad you guys listen, especially those of you that listen to us on iTunes. And if you want to know more about that, just go to the website for The Green Room, which is at witsendcomedyclub.com. Click on The Green Room, and there's a place there to subscribe. But on to more important matters. Our guest for this week is really a great act. He's a comedy magician or magician comic. I don't know what he is. We're going to find out. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Green Room, Gail Becquar. Good day, sir.
Hey, Vilmos. Thanks for having me.
I am so glad that you're on the show because I actually have only had one other guy on that did magic. And it was a fellow, his name's Andy Gross. He's from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And he bills himself as a comedian, magician, ventriloquist, which seemed to me to like he's catching everything.
Yeah.
But I have this thing, and tell me if I'm wrong. I kind of think all magicians use comedy anyway.
Well, you know what? That's a good question. I mean, you know, David Copperfield tries to be funny in his show, but and he, when the comedy boom hit 15, 20 years ago, he was trying to be more comical. But a lot of them do use a lot of comedy, and some are better at than others. But you know, some of the illusionists, they still use the dancing and the big. That was never my shtick, even growing up with my dad being a magician, and I never really cared for that type of magic, and neither did my dad. He was always kind of a comedian with his magician. So, yeah, technically you're right. I think a lot of magicians try to throw humor into it, and some of them are naturally funny, and some of them don't.
Well, yeah, that's just like we have comics that work that aren't very funny either. But
I know.
Not to really belabor the point, but are you a funny magician or a comedian that does magic?
You know, when I was in college, I entered a thing in 1984 here called Funniest Person in America contest, and I won the Nebraska thing. And I remember my girlfriend I was dating there, when she found out that I entered this Funniest Person in America contest, she goes, "Well, Gail, you're a magician. You're not a comedian." And I'd been doing magic all my life. My dad was a magician. I grew up doing it when I was 8 years old in my family's traveling magic show. And I knew by going to magic conventions and meeting these other magicians that the reason my magic worked was not because my magic was that good. It was because I was funny. And so I always thought I was just naturally funny with the magic. And so I always thought that I was a comedian who happened to do magic. But
okay,
there are a lot of magicians out there that happen to do comedy.
Well, right. And that's a fair that's why I want to make the distinction, because, you know, of the guys that I've seen, and I can only point out really the ones that have really made it up to the top, you know, I think Penn and Teller considered not just magicians. I think they're considered comedians. And of course, then the one guy I don't like him really because he does all the bloody stuff. I can't remember his name now, damn it. I'll remember it
later.
Amazing
Jonathan?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, yes.
He's too gross for me.
Yeah, he does a lot of blood and stuff like that. And then there was Kozak. He was real popular, too.
I've worked with Kozak.
Yeah, and he kind of has the laugh and afterward. And really, you know, they both have different styles of magic. I think my style is kind of and I've always been kind of this likable idiot. I've always envied, and when I was in college, Steve Martin was just starting out, and I really liked Steve Martin and Chevy Chase and Barney Fife, and those are the type of comic actors that I liked, and my magic kind of represents that. I kind of play the likable idiot. My magic wand, if you see people see the picture of Wits End, my magic wand is a paper towel tube, and my magic hat is a shower cap. So, I mean, quite honestly, I kind of make fun of magic in my work. I'm kind of the anti-magician, but for some reason, magicians love it, and they find it funny. So,
well, yeah. No, yours is great. I mean, your act is wonderful. It's very funny. It's entertaining. You're extremely likable on stage.
Well, right? Thank you very much. I think that's an important thing. I think a lot of magicians have trouble, and a lot of comedians, for that matter, have trouble being likable. You know, my sister Janine is a year younger than me, and she does maybe two shows a month here, just like banquets and conventions and corporate work, and she is extremely likable on stage. And my dad was always likable. My mom, so that works well for me, plus the comedy, plus the magic, plus the interaction. I listened to one of your shows previously, I think, with one of the comedians you had on, and John Cooney, who used to work at the Wits End, never cared for comedians going out into the audience and working. But he loved me going out in the audience. He said, "You are one of the better ones doing it." And quite honestly, that's what my show is a lot of interaction with the audience. I try to make fun of myself first. Obviously, if I'm wearing a shower cap and a paper towel, too, and making fun of myself, that lends itself to being, you know, a little bit nicer to the audience because I'm making fun of myself before I really ever have fun with them.
Right. No, it's wonderful. And the thing about it is you're kind of – you say you're – I tell you you're likable on stage, which is true. I'm actually not. I'm extremely hard to like on stage, and I think that hurts me. I know it hurts me. I shouldn't say I think it, but it's
not. One thing I find is sometimes there's another friend of mine who I work with. He is not very likable on stage, but he's one of the funniest writers I've ever met. And I tell him, I said, "Man, I wish I could write some jokes like you." I said, "Sometimes I think you need just to smile at the audience, pause, and you know, nod a little bit, and don't act so mean on stage." But you know, he's a great writer. Does great with the, with the comedy. So it works for him. But.
Sure. Well, you said you came from a family of magicians, right?
Yes.
I know you're over the age of 20, just by a few years. I'm wondering, has your dad passed?
He passed away 10 years ago in 1999, and my mom got remarried about 4 years ago, and
clown guy this time. No
was
more that? Magicians?
Yeah, she married a ventriloquist.
Yeah, something went off the reservation, did she?
Yeah. You know, when you mentioned at the very beginning the ventriloquist, the magician, the comedian, you know what that reminded me of? There used to be a movie called Magic, and it starred the guy from The Wolf.
Yeah, Anthony Perkins.
Thank you. Anthony Perkins and
Anne
Margaret.
Another creepy movie.
You know, and at the end of that, and if anybody watches that movie, at the end of that movie, the dummy gives away the trick of how Anthony Perkins got... Anthony Hopkins, I think it is.
Anthony Hopkins got
Anne Margaret to sleep with him. And I'm sitting there in the theater, and I'm in college, and I'm going, "Oh, my gosh, I didn't know how the trick worked." And I'm going, "Oh, that's right. That's how it's done." And so if you get the movie, folks, you'll be able to find out how that trick is done because the dummy gives away the trick. You know, he was kind of psycho anyway in that movie. And
Look, I'm telling you, I know Jeff Dunham because I worked with him a lot when he did the bone work and, you know, back in the day. And I've worked with other guys. I think all ventriloquists are creepy. I'm sorry.
Yeah. One thing about Dunham, you talk about likable, though. He did a show here in Lincoln, and I picked him up at the airport and worked with him on the college market. He is extremely likable.
Not only that, he's a very nice man.
Exactly. But, you know what? My dad, you know, this, coming back to my dad died in 99, but he had a heart attack in 97, and Jeff Dunham was here in town and doing a corporate show that I had done a couple years earlier, and they wanted somebody with a name and somebody a little bigger and got him flew him in. And anyway, he found out my dad just had a heart attack and was in the hospital a couple days, and after he got off stage to a standing ovation in front of a big corporate audience, first thing out of his mouth when he comes backstage to see me, he goes, "How's your dad doing?"
Yeah.
You know, extremely nice.
Not even surprised to hear that. A great guy. And actually, I couldn't be happier for him now. He's got a show on Comedy Central this fall. Mm-hmm. And I was watching the Comedy Central roast of Joan Rivers, which was horrendous. Mm-hmm. But he was doing little ads in between him and his characters.
Right.
And he's hysterical. But I'm sorry, a guy that talks to himself, uber creepy to me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. It's, and you know what? It isn't even talking to himself. I don't like the dolls.
Yep.
Eek.
Well, you know, magicians are kind of like that, too. I mean, I go to magic conventions, and I never cared. I'll be honest with you. I never cared for magicians because they would never tell you how the trick is done, and then they'd walk away and say, you know, one thing magicians always ask other magicians, they don't say, how did you do it? They go, hey, is that published? Which is a nice way of saying, can I buy that secret?
Right.
And, you know, so, but there are a few magicians that, you know, that I know that are funny, but most of them are kind of, you know, kind of creepy too.
Well, I don't know. Kozak, when I work with him, he gave me the thumb trick, which is probably the most rudimentary of all tricks, you know,
sure.
How to make things disappear. And I still actually have the thumb. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was very much presentation-wise, and, you know, his magic was okay. But I like, see, I think your magic is extremely good.
Thank you.
You know, I think it's, you know, Kozak got a huge deal wherever it was he's at in Vegas. I think your magic is far beyond what his was.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, yours is so engaging and so funny. But I want to go back to your family. That must have to do with the fact that your whole family was immersed in it, right?
Yes. I mean, you know, it's funny. I just came back from the Nebraska State Capitol. I live here in Lincoln, Nebraska. Today is my anniversary. My wife and I have been married 14 years, and ironically, we got married at the state capitol 14 years ago today because my first show was in 1967 as a little kid jumping out of a box in my dad's magic show. And it wasn't just the box trick. My dad had actually made it funny. He talked about how in the 1800s there were peddlers that would go from town to town and sell magic tonic to make you young. Well, he had four big plywood pieces of board, and they had Leroy the Great. That's what my dad used to go by, Leroy the Great's magic tonic, make you feel young again. And of course, my dad is in the centennial garb, wearing the hat and the vest and the beard, and my mom's out there wearing the centennial dress. And so he gets four or five men out of the audience, and they come up and they put this big rectangle together with the four sides. Then they put a roof on top of the kind of the big rectangle box. And it looks like a medicine wagon, but it's, you know, on the cement in front of the state capitol here in Lincoln. And he tells my mom, he goes, now, Irene, I want you to go inside the wagon and get some magic tonic. Well, my mom goes inside the wagon, and my sister, who was 2 years younger than me, 4 years old, comes out of the wagon, out of the box, with a half a bottle of tonic missing. And, of course, she's dressed exactly like my mom was, wearing the centennial dress, the bonnet. And, of course, my dad, being the comedian he is standing there going, well, Irene, honey, what happened to you? And he puts the microphone down to my sister Janine, who still does magic today, and when I was talking about earlier. And Janine says, well, I guess I drank some of this tonic, and it works faster than we thought. I'm a four-year-old now. So Dad says, well, you stay here. I'm going to go inside and get the anecdote. So he goes in the wagon. Now it's my turn to come out as a six-year-old boy. I come out, and I'm dressed exactly like him, beard, hat, beard, or vest, rather. And as I came out in front of the state capitol, if you've ever seen our Lincoln State Capitol, it's a big, huge, tall structure like the Empire State Building. All these people are on the steps. And I got stage fright. I looked up at the microphone that my dad had left at 6 feet tall. I'm just a little kid. And when I looked up, Vilmos, my beard fell off onto the ground.
Oh, man.
And I remember these – I remember like it was yesterday. I remember these 10, 12-year-old boys going, hey, wait a minute. That's not the same guy. That's not the same guy. And I thought the trick was that I was supposed to be Leroy the Great. And so I started crying when my sister Janine – and we're pretty close. She lives here in Lincoln. Like I said, does magic still today. And she grabs me, and we go back in the little wagon. My mom and dad come out, and we disappear. Well, my dad, back in the 1967, 1970s, when we'd perform with him, would give Janine and I, and I have two other sisters too, Janice and Joyce, each a dollar if we would ever help him out do magic.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was making 150, 200 bucks a show back then. Then I found out what I was making. I go, hey, what is this, a sweatshop? Give me some more money. But you know, a dollar was a lot of money to us. We were just little kids. And,
sure.
And I did not take the dollar that day. I go, Dad, I'm sorry I screwed up the trick. My beard fell off. And he goes, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me, Gail? He goes, that was what made it funny.
Absolutely.
He goes, when your beard fell off and you looked up, the expression on your face, and of course Dad was kind of peeking out the side, he goes, made all the adults laugh. Now, granted, those 10-year-old boys were kind of mean to you, but he goes, I'd like to keep that in the show if you don't mind. And And I go, "You mean you want my beard to fall off every day?" And he goes, "Yeah." So that was my first joke. It happened by chance. So I'd come out, the beard would fall off. I'd pick it up, put it back in, and run in the box. And so once again, my dad was kind of a comedian who happened to do magic. And I was definitely influenced by him. And he gave me some advice that day that I'll never forget. And I even showed my girls the Capitol where it happened today just a couple hours ago. We went downtown to Lincoln here, and I showed them where my beard fell off. And they're eight years old now, mm-hmm. So they about my age when I was their age. But anyway, I told them, I said, "Dad told me something I always remember." He goes, "Entertain an audience first and fool them second." He goes, "It's not the trick that makes the magician good. It's the presentation." You know, and that's true in any job. You know, it's not what you do. It's how you do it. So anyway, I've learned to remember that, and that's kind of my philosophy now.
Well, that's very – you know what? The fact that you're doing things with your dad and he was very important to you is just makes the whole thing even more special. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure that you feel a lot of times when you're doing your show do you feel like it's kind of an homage to your family and your father specifically?
Yes, you know what? And my dad passed away in 99, and I've gone home and, you know, found a lot of his old magic stuff. He did a trick one time where his voice – would pick a card. It was on cassette tape recorder. And so I went back and did his alumni banquet. He would have been out 50-some years. And I just went there last year, and I did this trick. Everybody else was still living in his grade at the time. And I did this trick, and they hired me to do the magic, but they didn't know I was that Leroy Beckwer, their classmate who had died, you know, 5 years earlier, his voice would come on and actually do a trick and pick a card at the end.
Nice.
So that was real special. And I know David Copperfield did something on one of his TV specials where Orson Welles' voice does a trick. And, of course, Orson Welles had passed away. So I kind of got the idea from there. But I'll be honest with you. I go, it was a totally different trick. And my dad's voice, obviously, with all his classmates and my mom and my uncle being there, was kind of a touching moment for everybody.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
But I got to tell you a funny story. My dad's been buried he's been dead now 10 years. He's buried in Meligan. And on his grave, he's got a trick. And here, I'll just do it to you real quick, okay?
Okay.
Think of a simple number between 1 and 10, but don't tell me what it is. And anybody listening out there can do this too. Think of a number between 1 and 10, but don't tell me what it is.
Okay.
Multiply that number times 2.
Okay.
Okay. Add 10 to that total.
All right.
Okay. Okay. Divide that total in half.
All right.
And here's the final step. Subtract the original number from that total.
Okay.
So what you did is you thought of a number, you multiplied it times 2, you added 10, you divided that in half, and then you subtracted the original number.
Right.
Well, my dad has this on his gravestone. He goes, "I'm reading your mind from the grave."
Yeah.
And he goes, "Now go to the other side of my tombstone." And on the tombstone it says, "If you followed these steps in order, I'm reading your mind from the grave. You ended up with a final total of 5.
Oh, that's very cool.
So Memorial Day, people are coming to my dad's grave, still doing the, you know, and obviously, it's a mathematical thing. And, you know, David Copperfield used to do something on television where you point on the screen and you'd be in the same room. And
right, exactly.
Mathematical works out. I mean, I've never been one of these magicians that really felt like if you learn the secret, it's that big a deal.
Uh-huh.
Now, granted, I don't give away the secrets. I'm not like the masked magician on Fox TV.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking of.
But you know, at the same time, you know, those magic specials, whether they're positive or negative, seem to give magic more advertising. So, you know, maybe if he was giving away my tricks on stage, maybe I'd be a little bit more upsetting. But, you know, I think the comedy and the interaction that I do with the audience is stronger than my magic anyway. So,
do you really?
Yeah, I kind of do. I mean, I've got some of the tricks I do have some pretty tough moves in them, and they do fool magicians. I'll admit that. But overall, I mean, to answer your very first question, I think I've always been a comedian first, a magician second.
Sure. Yeah.
But I love magic, and I don't think I'd ever lose it because I don't think I'm funny enough without the magic. I'll be honest. I think the two go hand in hand.
Really? So if somehow, let's say you had a horrible bowling accident that caused you to wrench both of your wrists, and you were wearing casts on both wrists where you couldn't move your hands at all.
Yeah.
Would you, and you had to do a show that was going to pay you $15,000.
I'd be doing a lot of mathematical tricks, wouldn't I, on stage?
So you don't think you could pull it off just as a comedian? I think you're charming enough and you're likable enough to be able to do that.
Thank you. You know, and I have, you know, and when you're on the radio, you can't do magic. So I have done some jokes on the radio for different, you know, comedy clubs. I remember the first one I did. Remember, I have three sisters, Joyce, Janine, and Janice. And uh-huh. I always tell people I wasn't going to get into magic, but they make $100 a trick. I figure, why can't I? You know.
Good thing they're not listening.
Well, Janine always says, Gail, and you know what's funny, Vilmos? I'll say that, and then you know a tagline is something that you say right after a joke that gets a second laugh. I'll usually say, I go, I'm kidding, folks. They don't make that much.
Yes.
And that gets a laugh number two. And then you'll say, they make $200 a trick. You can't get nothing for $100 nowadays, can you? And that gets laugh number three. So as a comedian, you know, you want to get laugh one, laugh two, laugh three, and hopefully the audience is with you.
Yes, that's a rule that you guys may – we probably never talked about this, but the rule of threes is big in the comedy world.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have that.
You know, I went and saw Jerry Seinfeld when he was here about a month ago, and – that guy will have like 7 or 8 or 10, you know, rule of joke after joke after joke on from the same topic.
Yeah, well, he's good at beating them into the ground, so yeah. Good for him. All right, folks, so listen, we made up to our first break. We're going to come back with a little bit more from Gail Becquar right after this. Hang right on. Do you have something special coming up for your company or your organization, like maybe a big fundraiser? Have you thought about renting Wits End Comedy Club? We can provide comedians for the event, help your organization have a great party or a great fundraising event. Very easy to do. You want more information, go to the website, www.witsendcomedyclub.com. Click on the More button, and then you'll see a Rent the Club item. Click on that. We seat up to 230 people, have a great staff. And don't forget, it's the new room, so it's actually one of the finest clubs in the country, certainly the finest club in Denver. If you don't want to go to the website, do it the old-fashioned way. Just pick up the phone and call 303-430-4242. All right, back with Gail Becquar. You know, it seemed to me when I was listening to your three sisters, did your dad want all girls?
You know,
no offense.
Because he named me Gail. What was he thinking?
Well, but that could be a guy's name, too. I mean, that's one of those unisex names.
Yeah, what is Vilmos, by the way? I got to ask
it's,
you that.
It's Hungarian for William.
Okay.
I'm actually the 18th generation in my family to have the name. They pass it down lineage to lineage, but not necessarily always from father to son. Like, it might be two brothers, and one of them's Vilmos, but the other brother, you know, maybe his name's Karchi or something. He names his son Vilmos.
I see. Well, so. I was almost Leroy Jr., so I like Gail.
Do you?
But, I mean, my middle name is Leroy, so I always tell people Gail Leroy sounds like a gay cowboy. But anyway, you know what? I have an older sister, Joyce, and then I came along, and then Janine is a year younger than me. She's the one that lives here in Lincoln and does about 2 magic shows a month. Joyce still does about 2 or 3 a year. And then my younger sister, Janice, she lives in Omaha, and she really does. She's got little kids right now and hasn't really gotten into magic, but she was very talented and did magic in high school too. So my dad got us all involved in magic when we were very young, and I was the only boy, and I know that he was real happy because he came to a lot of my shows. I've been doing this now 20 years, and he came to a lot of my shows and would travel with me. I was very proud when I would do magic.
Now I'll
be honest, I didn't take his other love. He was a TV repairman and fixed TVs and sold TVs and radios and stuff, and that's when TVs broke down and people would get them repaired. Now you just throw them away and go to Walmart and get a new one. But back then they put tubes in. And Vilmos, I will go back to where I grew up in Davenport, Nebraska, in Thayer County. And there's like a 4-county region where my dad would travel around and fix TVs.
Uh-huh.
And to this day, and I've done a few county fair shows in these counties, people will come up to me and will say, and they're my age, they'll say, you know, we always wished that our TV would break down because your dad would come and fix our TV and spent an hour afterwards doing magic tricks to us. And he did. I think he did more magic than he did fixing TVs. But, of course, back then that didn't pay the bills, and he wasn't a full-time magician. He just did it kind of part-time.
Well, I was going to ask you, when the TV was done, did he actually have it under some kind of cloth, and he just pulled it up, ta-da?
Yeah, ta-da.
You know, did a little wand tap on it, you know, and it's on.
Yeah, and it's on. Pop, there it is.
But, so, you know, like, he wasn't full-time ever? Always did something else?
Well, towards the end, you know, the one, you know, he died at 65, so the last 10 years, TVs were people already still going. His business, TV business, made it hardly anything. And I had a booking agency, which I still do in Lincoln here, and I started booking him. And he would do 5-6 shows a month for me, corporate shows, and a lot of times he'd make $500 to $1,000 a show. So he was obviously making more money, I think, back then from doing magic than he was the TV business. Plus, he would still book himself.
Sure.
Know, for little things.
Oh, well, the corporate show, no offense, and I don't want to talk about your business specifically, but no. I saw your schedule one year,
yeah,
and I did the quick edition in my head, and I considered picking up magic.
Well, you know what? I have a lot of comedian friends that picked up hypnosis because they could make a lot more money doing comedy hypnosis at a function than they could at, just comedy.
Yeah, but pound for pound, I think a magician goes over a lot better than a comedian because – or a ventriloquist, a hypnotist. Gosh,
you know, I agree with you. We can't – you know, hypnosis is fun, and I like hypnotists, anybody listening out there, but as a booking agent too, and we don't – book a lot of hypnotists unless it's after prom season, you know, or during the after prom shows or maybe the college shows, because not too many corporate audience want to bark like a dog in front of their boss.
Right. It's a hard sell.
It is a hard sell.
And plus you got the prop, you have the issue of everybody worrying about, like you said, what am I going to say? Mm-hmm. Or are they going to find out I'm looking at the secretaries when they're bending over or whatever it is, you know, there's all these things that go along with that are negative.
Well, you know, the hypnotist, a lot of them take a class in 2 weeks. They're a hypnotist.
Yeah.
Magic, ventriloquism, it's going to take you a lot more. It's going to take you 2 years. So I think a lot – and I have had a couple comedians try to learn magic, and they go, oh, this is tougher than I thought it was. And I said, yeah, because first of all, you've got to pull the trick off. You got to fool them, and you got to make it entertaining. And same with ventriloquism. And impressions, too. There's a lot of people that try to do impressions. If they're not dead on or if the comedy isn't there, you're not that great of an impressionist either. So.
Right. Well, it's rare that, you know, it's rare that I get to talk to somebody that not only does stage work but also books, you know, action other than themselves.
And I'll be honest with you, I never wanted to do that, but people would come up to me at the end of my show and say, hey, who could you recommend for us next year? And I would write down 3 or 4 names and put their phone numbers on there, and I said, call this guy up. Well, 2 things would happen. They would either lose that piece of paper or they'd call the comedian up, and you know us, we're on the road a lot. The comedian would never call back.
Right.
And so it made me look bad. So I met my wife in 1991. I was working here at the Funny Bone in Lincoln here with Phyllis Diller, and she started booking me, and she came up to me after the show, and she said, hey, do you have any representation? And, you know, I said, yeah, here's my business card, thinking she wanted to hire me for a private event, a company Christmas party or an awards dinner or whatever. And she said, no, I don't want to book you. I want to help represent you. I thought you were funny. And I go, you're the one. I knew somebody thought I was funny. And so she started booking me, and we started dating, and then we got married in 95, like I said, 14 years ago today. And she said the only reason I married her is I was tired of giving her 15-20% commission. Of course, if you're married, you know you give them a lot more than that after you marry them.
Yeah, but you raised it up. This is not a good deal for you.
But she always wanted to be a booking agency. And she always wanted to be a booking agent. So she started booking other acts, and so then I just kind of help her out. But it's always been her that wanted to do it first. Now, I did book my dad and my sister a few shows before I met her, but not really any other comedians.
But you also used to run a room in Lincoln.
Yes, we had a comedy club, and I remember you calling. We had a comedy club downtown by the college, and it was like in 1999, about 10 years ago, 1998. I remember you told me, you probably don't remember this, but you said you called, and I was one of the few booking agents that actually talked to you for a long time, because most booking agents, first of all, you can't get in touch with them, or
right.
Comedy club owners. Secondly, you know, they treat the comedian sometimes like we're prostitutes and they're the pimps, and I hate that. So I vowed that I would never do that. Any comedian that would call me for work, I would talk to them, tell them to mail me their stuff, look at it, and be, you know, and be just nice to them.
Yeah. Well, I think when I called towards the end of when you were doing the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I was still an opener at the time. And I thought, you know, I'd do okay. but it never worked out. It's kind of funny. I had that experience with you in Lincoln, and I'm not going to mention names because I'm not really harboring any ill will against this person, but I will tell you that I called another comedy club in Omaha. Mm-hmm. And I happened to mention to this person that picked up the phone, I said, I know somebody in Omaha. I know Doug McCraw.
Sure.
Which was the worst thing I could have possibly said, because this person hated Doug McCraw.
You know,
Doug McCraw? Well, you're never working for me. And I'm thinking, oh, my God.
Why is it comedy club agents and managers, and for some reason, they hate competition. They hate, you know, the other person. And Doug, of course, had a comedy club and also was a booking agent too.
Well, this was before he was booking. He has a company still called Comedy Express.
Sure.
And he was booking comedians at that time. And this person, somehow or another, they'd gotten sideways. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And I was just frightened. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I waited 6 months. And then I figured maybe that was enough time for her to forget me.
Right.
And I called back, and I got a guest set, and I've been working at the Funny Bone ever since.
Well, you know, when I called her one time, she said the same thing to me, and I was working with Bob Zaney down at Doug's club, and she goes, well, Gail, I called to work to her room, and she goes, well, Gail, I see you're working the other comedy club in Omaha, and I said, yeah, and she was actually the one, she's the one that got me the Phyllis Diller gig here back in 1991 here in Lincoln at the old Lincoln Funny Bone.
Yeah.
Anyway, she said, well, I see you work there, and if you work their club, you won't work my club.
Yeah.
And she goes, but no hard feelings. Merry Christmas. It was Christmas time. And I go, okay, at least you're honest. I got to give her credit for being honest. But
no, yeah, and you know what? We got three other clubs here in Denver.
Now, can every comedian – I don't know about – I'm not from Denver, but can comedians work all three?
I think you can.
Well,
I will say this. We have no problem with anybody working another club in town.
Good for you.
We don't care. The only thing we have a problem with is probably, and not even that big of a deal, probably can't go back-to-back weeks.
No. Yeah, like, and that's exactly
right. You
got to
have some sort of cooling off period.
Yeah, I'd say at least 4, 5, 6 months. It's definitely 6 months if you're a headliner. And so, you know, I don't know why it's that big a deal, but apparently in some cities it is.
Well, it's a big deal. It's a lot of places you got to pick one.
Yeah.
You know, Milwaukee was that way. They would let you work, you know, both rooms if you were middle. But once you're a headliner, you picked one, and that was all you got.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess I can see that. I mean, I'll be the first to admit I love comedy clubs, and I love working with other comedians because I feel like, you know, you can bounce ideas off them, and I just like it, you know. But most of my income, 80% of it probably comes from the corporate convention banquet circuit. And I started off there, Vilmos. I mean, I can remember a comedy club owner saw me at the Cornhusker Hotel here in Lincoln and said, you'd be a great comedian. And this is like 1987. And I said, well, I'm kind of a magician comedian. And he goes, no. He goes, you're funny. You don't need the magic. And that made me feel good. So he booked me down in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I was an MC and did really well at the MC spot. And he moved me up the second time I came back 6 months later to feature, and then he moved me up about 6 months later to headliner. So I kind of climbed the rank real quick, but it was because of the magic. I mean, I had been performing all my life and was a corporate entertainer first, and so, the, you know, kind of moved up pretty quick to headliner. But there's really no other place to go once you're a headliner. So, and I know that there's some comedy clubs where they don't usually put a variety act at the headliner spot. I know I think the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach, the magician comedian is always the feature, always in the middle.
Really?
Yeah, not too many, unless you're Amazing Jonathan, not too many comedian magicians get the headlining spot.
Well, I didn't know that.
No, and it's kind of sad. I mean, you have to have that national TV before you do. They just like the variety in between, you know, the comedy, then the variety comedy, then the comedy again.
Hmm.
And it's, you know, it's an A room, it's a big club, you know, Jay Leno would do his stuff there. Before the Tonight Show, so.
Wow. Well, we have another comic on our roster, Lamont Ferguson. That's his home club, and you know you don't hear many people talking about that club, even though it has quite a bit of prominence.
Yeah.
Hmm. Now you started in '87, then.
Yep.
And
yep.
So has there ever been a time where you've done more clubs than private events, kind of things? Or has it always been? Or has it always been, you know, kind of lopsided this way?
That's a good question. You know, starting out, in 87, I lost my job. I was a salesman here selling food for a food distributor. Literally, had done a couple shows for them. You know, and this is going to sound weird because I know I sound outgoing over the phone, but I would go to this job, and I was on the phone, And I wouldn't really talk to anybody. I was kind of introverted. And after becoming a comedian, most comedians, as you know, are kind of introverted.
Yes, we are.
When they're not on the telephone, when they're not on stage, when they're not at a comedy club. And they found out I did magic comedy on the weekends. And so they said, hey, Gail, would you do a little bit of time at our corporate, at our sales meeting? I said, well, yeah, I guess I could. And so the guy introduced me. He goes, folks, we got a guy, our own salesman. We find out that he actually does some shows on the weekend. We didn't know this. We decided to take a chance on him and let him perform here at our sales meeting. They weren't paying me nothing, and he said it that way. And I got up, and everybody just, you know, I'm not trying to be boastful or anything, but they just couldn't. They saw another side to me, and they laughed and had a good time. Well, there was a couple national salespeople there that said, what is this kid doing at the order desk? Get him out, you know, out on the road or as a bigger salesman. Well, they never did. And then about a month or two later, they called me in the office and said, Gail, you just don't look happy here. And I was up for a raise. And they said, we're going to have to let you go. No warning, nothing. Fired me on the spot.
Oh,
and I had
no.
been the top in-house salesman that month. And so I went to the discrimination office, and they said, you got a bunch of things working against you. You're young, you're white, and you're a male. He yeah. goes, you know, and you know, he says, if you'd have been a woman or a minority, you might have a chance of beating this. But he goes, do you really want the job back? And I said, no, not really.
Yeah.
And so anyway, and then I did a show at the Cornhusker, you know, and this comedy club owner saw me, and he said, hey, I know you've got a full-time job, but could you take a couple days off and come down to Tulsa, Oklahoma?
Wow.
And of course, I said, you know, I can take more than just 2 days off. And so I went and did some shows for him, and that was 87, and he started booking me. And so that first year, it was probably 50-50. It was funny, though, Vilmos. I was living with this girl at the time, and I remember she didn't even know I lost my job. And that night, I came home, and I was about ready to tell her I got fired from the job.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, Gail, I'm just not happy anymore. And she broke up with me before I could even tell her I lost my job.
Dude, you know what?
I felt like Bill Murray from the movie Stripes. Remember, that happens to Bill Murray, and he joins the Army. But I like to sleep till noon, so that it wouldn't work for me. But
you know, it's funny how you have common threads with people, because you've done two things, and I don't remember what the other one was, that were exactly almost the same that happened to me. Because I used to work for a finance company out in California, and I went to a meeting where they fired all of us. They closed every office in the country, mm-hmm. told us we had like a couple weeks, and then they were going to get rid of us. I had moved out to California, had no friends, no money, no nothing other than what my job was. Had no idea how I was going to get home, what I was going to do. Went home, found out my wife was cheating on me, and she was leaving me.
Oh, my God.
So,
same thing.
I wanted to go find a bridge and just jump.
I know. Did you get into comedy from there then, or what
no,
happened?
No, I did that a long time afterwards. I'm the classic introvert comedy guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I talk more on this program and on stage than I ever do off stage. And in fact, that was the other story, come to think of it. I live in a small town, Florence, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody in town knows me because at one time I owned the local video store. So I got guys that come up to me that say, I remember when I was 5 years old, I would come in and rent my movies and, you know, all that. And they all know my kids. I had three kids that went to school here, grew up. My girls were on the sports teams, blah, 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 right?
Sure.
So the cops here, I also am a computer guy at times. And I used to work on the police department's computer systems. And the cops would always say, well, we want to see a show. You want to see a show, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay. And I'm not big on that. I don't know how you are about it. But I'm not one that's boastful.
Right.
And I'm not even saying it's boastful to say, hey, I'm doing a show this week if you want to come and watch. I have a hard time doing that because I don't know if I want people to see me
right.
that know me, right?
Okay.
I don't care if anybody else sees me. If I don't know you, I'll do a show in front of you. I have no reservations at all.
Well, my wife's got these new friends, and they came out and saw me at the Lincoln Comedy Club, and it was like, oh, my gosh, you're good at this. You know, they see a different side to you when you're on stage, you know.
That's the whole thing I'm afraid of.
Yeah.
So I have this guy. His name's Errol Wright. Very nice man. And I said, okay, Errol, I'm going to be up at the show on Saturday. And if you want to come watch, come up, I'll comp you, blah, blah, blah. So he comes up, and he does the show, and he says goodbye, and he goes home. And, I don't think anything of it. Week later, he pulls me over. He actually turns the lights on. He pulls me over. He comes up. I go, Errol, was I speeding him or something? He goes, no. He said, I just want to tell you, I went to that show, and I remember thinking when I was driving up to Colorado Springs, it's a 45-minute drive for those of you that are listening. He said the whole time I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to say to him because I know he's not going to be funny. Right. So I don't know what I'm going to say after he's done. And so he said, I watch your show, and he said, I got to tell you, I can never look at you the same way again. You're absolutely hysterical. I didn't know, even know what to say. That's why I didn't say anything to you when I left. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, that's really nice, but, you know, can you not pull me over in the middle of town, please?
You know, it's funny with the cops. I had a cop literally pull me. I was coming back from Wits End. This is so strange. My first time I showcased at Wits End, and John Cooney pulled me aside and said, what week do you want? And that was very unheard of. Usually you had to call him back up. I just went there on a Sunday night, did 10 minutes. Elliot Threet, I was headlining at the time, and I knew Elliot from Kansas City, still do, and went on, did like 10 minutes. And I was so happy that I got a, you know, got in and got a week. I drove back from Denver all the way to Lincoln, and I'm in western Nebraska. Anybody that travels through western Nebraska, you know how boring it can be. And I was driving pretty fast. And this is when the laser actually came out. This is years ago. And I remember the cop pulled me over, and I was going probably 85 miles an hour on the road. This is before it was 75, and when it was still 65. And he pulled me over, and he looked at me, and he goes, I got you with laser. And I go, what's laser? And he showed me what it was. He goes, come on back here. And he looks at me, and he goes, hey, you did our show, didn't you? I said, yeah, I'm a comedian magician. I did the State Patrol show last month. And he goes, yeah, you're really funny. And he was such a nice guy. He gave me a warning for going 85 miles an hour.
Nice.
And that's the only time. You know, most of the time guys always get nailed for anything. And he goes, hey, I'm going to give you a warning, but don't you dare tell anybody about that. Well, of course, now I'm telling everybody, hey, guess who got a warning going 85?
Oh, my God.
But you know, another time, and not too far from here, they were working where I live here in Lincoln, they were working on the road, and this is a true story. There was a yellow flashing light at a major intersection, and I had a few beers, and I shouldn't drink and drive, but anyway, I stopped at this yellow flashing light, and it was a construction area, and the cop pulled me over for driving too cautiously, and of course gave me the breath test. I flunked.
Wow. Now,
yes, and this is about 15 years ago. Anyway, anybody who's ever had a when you flunk the breath test, they put handcuffs on you. And, of course, the joke is I tell people, I go, folks, you put handcuffs on a drunk magician, it's showtime. And I'm not kidding you. My dad showed me how to get out of them a long time ago. And so I gave the handcuffs back to the guy. And he goes, how the hell did you do that? And he puts them back on. Now he puts them on tighter this time, takes me downtown. I had to blow into a bigger tube, felt like Richard Simmons. And I flunked that too. Well, now I got to call a friend of mine up to come and get me. While I'm waiting, and anybody who's a magician, you know, usually a magician has a deck of cards on him. I had a deck of cards in my pocket. I started doing some card tricks. I had 5 or 6 cops looking at me going, hell, we know you're drunk, but you're fooling the hell out of us. So I got and this is a true story. 2 months, you never know where your next show is going to come from. 2 months later, the same officer calls me up, and he goes, hey, is this Gale Beckwith, magician comedian? And I go, yeah, it sure is. He goes, this is Officer McKinley. I got you for DWI a couple months ago, and he goes, hey, I'm in charge of getting some entertainment this year for a policeman's ball. I was so close to saying, hey, I thought you guys didn't have any balls, but but I didn't. You know what I did? My dad always told me, never get mad, always get even.
Sure.
I raised my normal price about $800 to cover the fine. I asked him for a ride. I made money on my DWI. Can you believe that?
Oh man, what a
and I got a show. But you know what? You know, you talked about doing stuff. People, you know, will see you in a different limelight after you entertain for them. And I never wanted to use that, you know, as a way to get out of a ticket. This guy was a super nice cop to pull me over for a speeding ticket in western Nebraska. But
yeah.
But it was nice.
They're doing their jobs.
Yes.
And they're doing a very hard job. And we're doing something that's wrong.
Yeah.
I mean that's the long and short of it. So, listen, we hit our second break time, so we're going to do that. Ladies and gentlemen, we will be coming back with the convicted felon, Gale Beckwith, right after this. Hang on. How does $5,000 sound? That's right, $5,000 for your organization by holding a comedy fundraiser at Wits End Comedy Club. And it couldn't be simpler. We host a comedy night to benefit your cause. We provide you with a 90-minute comedy show on any available night we have. It couldn't be simpler.
You just go out, sell the tickets. We take care of all the rest, and then you take the money, and that's how it works. All you have to do this is just pick up the phone and call 303-430-4242, or you can go to our website, www.witsendcomedyclub.com, click the fundraising button, and then just put in a little information. We'll get a hold of you and explain to you how it all works. It's easy, it's different, and there's no better way to raise money for your organization.
All right, so I'm not going to one-up you, but I'm going to tell you my cop story.
Yeah, tell
since
me.
We're back with Gail Buchwar. I used to live in town, and your dad was a famous TV repairman. My dad happened to be one of the local doctors.
Okay.
All right, and my dad passed a couple years ago at 91. And I was always a constant irritant to my father, poor guy. Thank God I didn't shorten his life, or if I did, he was going to live to be 110 or something.
Was your father funny too, like you? Or
my dad was the most stoic guy on the planet.
Okay.
I got my sense of humor, if I have one, from my mom.
Okay.
We used to do my dad was a doctor in a very smaller town, and he actually had every policeman in town was his patient. Mm-hmm. I don't know why this is. But he just did. And the funny thing about it was my mom one day, when I was a kid, I used to get high. And that was kind of swept under the rug a little bit. One time my dad found one of my bongs and really ripped my ass. But for the most part, if I didn't come in swaying too bad, they kind of left me alone. My sure. grades were good, etc. Well, one day my mom gets a hold of some of my seeds. She decides to grow a pot plant right on the front counter at my dad's office.
Mm-hmm.
So this plant is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it gets to, like, I don't know, a foot high over the course of time. Finally, one of the cops that comes in and goes, "Is that a marijuana plant?" My mom goes, "Why, yes, it is." And the guy goes, "That's illegal." She goes, "Yes, it is. I know this." He goes, "Why are you doing it?" She goes, "I just want to find out if you guys know how to do your job." And, you know, that's the kind of thing my mom used to do. And she was just a kind of a nutball, you know. But
yeah.
I was just that way. So we knew all the cops in town, right? And
yeah.
I'm driving home one day, and it's 18. You could drink in Wisconsin. I lived in Illinois. You drink in Wisconsin, and you get home through Illinois where I lived. And we would be pretty inebriated, right? Mm-hmm. And I got pulled over actually a block away from my house.
Okay.
And it was a new guy. And I get out of the car, and the guy goes, have you been drinking? I go, yeah, but I'm a block from my house. And I'm sure I didn't say it without slurring my words. And he goes, well, we're going to have to give you the field test. And I'm going through that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, I'm just a block. I'll lock the car. I'll walk the rest of the way home, you know. And I'm not thinking clearly. And he goes, no, sir, we got to do this. So I'm going through the field sobriety. And up pulls the shift commander, a guy. His name is Lieutenant Fisher, big black fella. And he gets out of the car, and the guy goes, is this Vilmos Brandyk? And the guy goes, yeah. He goes, come back here. And I hear him screaming at the guy, why don't you let him walk home? Don't you know he's a block away from his goddamn house? What are you wasting your time for? Let that poor boy go home. And I'm looking at the guy going, I told you, I was a block away from the house. Glad to walk home. So that's the kind of life I lived. And I've always been, you know, lucky. Fortunately, I never killed anybody who I was driving or any of that stuff. And I don't do that anymore.
Right.
But I've always had a great respect for policemen because they got an awfully, awfully difficult job.
In cops, some of, you know, when they're not, and I've done a lot of private shows for cops and anybody in a high-stress job, whether they're doctors or lawyers or trauma trend people that are in emergency rooms, they cut loose when they're partying at Christmas parties, and they're just as funny and drink just as much as anybody else.
Well, they're hilarious, too.
Yeah. You know what? I did a show for the Nebraska Funeral Directors, and I thought it would be a dead crowd, no pun intended.
No way.
They were so much fun. You know, it was, like, amazing.
Oh, absolutely. I remember a local funeral director, when I was younger, I used to drive a snowplow back in Illinois, mm-hmm. do private lots, and he comes out one day, they had this real heavy, wet snow, you know?
Right.
Comes out with this big smile on his face. He goes, what are you smiling about? He goes, I'm waiting for the phone to ring. So, you know, some poor old guy out there, you know, shoveling his thing. Anyway, listen, I want to go back to the comedy thing.
Sure.
You do clubs.
Right.
Have you suffered through the one-nighters like a lot of comics?
Oh, yeah. You know what? Because right away, being a comedian, to get to the A rooms, to get to the week-long rooms, you have to call over and over and over again. And I'm not one of these guys that, you know, calls more than once or twice. And, you know, you just don't get in. So a lot of times you end up doing except with you, you know, you guys got a great room at Wits End, and I love doing your room, and I love doing the rooms I do get in. I love performing, but a lot of them are one-nighters that you know will hire you. So I've done a ton of one-nighters.
Okay.
And you travel from here to here, and they usually pay a little bit better, but sometimes the audience can be bad. And there are nights where I'm on a dance floor in front of a pink light, and I'm thinking to myself, man, I'm glad I have the magic. Or you'll be in the middle of a casino, and people are gambling around you, and I'll look at the other comedian, and I go, here, you want to take the magic case on stage?
But are those harder crowds to work than? Because a comedy club crowd, kind of focused, mm-hmm. not real drunk. You know, one-nighters, they're shiny object people. Is that magic really better for that?
I think so. I think, and I think magicians and variety acts have a little easier time at the one-nighters because they're not used to the comedy as much. And I know a lot of comedy one-nighters will start off usually with a variety act just to kind of get them trained. And I'll be the first to admit that I think the variety act has it a little bit easier. But at the same time, you still have to be entertaining. And if the room's set up right, you know the setup is so important at any show you do.
Yeah.
I was listening to another one of your shows with Scotty Goff on there, and he said how he had to do a corporate once on the diving board.
Yes, that's right. He was talking about that.
That reminded me, I did one around a pool area too, and people were splashing, and I just hated that one. And I thought, gosh, it could be worse. I could be on the diving board like Scotty Goff, you know.
Oh, absolutely. You want to just hope that the water drains out, you can just jump to the concrete, right?
Yeah, that's yeah. You feel like a street performer when you're doing these outdoor shows. You have to kind of engage the audience, break the wall. And, you know, some comedians make good money at it. I know there was a guy out in Venice Beach. Oh, I can't remember his name, but he made good money passing the hat just doing comedy.
Really?
Yeah, he was on the cover. He was on the cover of the. Remember the magazine Just for Laughs? That was
years ago. It was when I first started.
Yep, when I first started too. I remember working in the Tulsa, Oklahoma room, and I remember Tony DePaul was the headliner, and I think I was the feature at that time. And he said to me, he goes, Gail, he goes, you could do TV. And he goes, you're likable, you got the comedy, you don't really need the magic. And he took the Just for Laughs and he circled all the comedy clubs for me to call. Because Tony DePaul had owned and ran the Holy City Zoo in San Francisco and was a member, I guess, of Papaya Juice, which was an improv troupe when Robin Williams started.
Wow.
So anyway, we sat, and I remember at Denny's restaurant at 2 in the morning, and he circled all the clubs for me to call. Well, you know, I got home here to Lincoln. I call him up. You don't get in touch, and you got to keep at it. It's like applying for a job, you know. It's the same thing over and over. A comedian is constantly applying for a job, and sometimes it's tougher. And if you're not persistent, you know, sometimes you don't get in. But then again, sometimes you can be too persistent, too. I'm sure you've had tons of people call you up to try to get booked into Wits End that you don't even
honestly, talk. I take no calls.
Good for you.
And it's not that I don't want to talk to people. Comics, I hate to say this, but comics are like telemarketers.
Mm-hmm.
If you start picking up the phone, and I'll give you great props for the way you did it.
Right.
But if you start picking up the phone... you will never do anything else.
You'll be on the phone all day long.
That's all you will do is talk to people. And what I did was, as you know, I put together a website. And all of my bookings for the club are done by the web.
Which is a great way of doing it. I suppose a lot of clubs are doing it that way now, aren't they?
No, nobody does it that
nobody
way.
Nobody does it that way? Mm-hmm. Well, I know a lot of people, everything's email. I know a few agents that they won't even take any calls. You got to email them. But
email is fine, but I'd rather have a format where, and the biggest problem you have when you're a comedian is you don't know where you stand.
Right.
Everybody that is on our roster knows they're on our roster, mm-hmm. and everybody that's not knows they're not.
Okay.
And it's very clear when you go to the website to – put in your available dates, what's available.
Mm-hmm.
There's no big secret. There's a week available. It's on the website.
Sure.
If it's not available, it's not there. No need to call. No need to check.
Well, yeah. And
you know?
Because it's a lot of wasted time for the comedians at other clubs and a lot of wasted time for the booking agent telling people that that's already filled, you know?
Right. Well, your choices are either to ignore them. It's the same with email. I get... and thankfully, I don't. I know comics. In fact, I'm talking about Russ Rivas,
sure,
who used
Russ.
To own a club also.
Mm-hmm.
Russ told me that he got, on average, 300 email messages a day from comics. I'm not talking about spam even. I'm just talking about 300 emails relating to, can I work at the club? Are you booking comics? Blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get any of that. I have a page you go to that says, this is how you get into the club. This is how we book the club. This is what you got to do to get into the club. If you don't meet these criteria, you just quit reading here, and it's great. We love you.
Hey, you got to ask Russ Rivas if he's wearing fake eternity, because that's an inside joke between my wife and him. When I first worked with Russ, he was opening for me, and we did a bunch of one-nighters for Dave Tribble, a booking agent. And I remember Russ told me, he goes, "Gail," he would always wear the cologne and everything.
Russ is something.
And he goes, "Hey, Gail," he goes, "smell me." I go, "Hey, that's pretty good stuff." He goes, "Fake eternity, $5, you know." And
Russ.
I go, and so anyway, he met my girlfriend at the time, Cindy, and he had asked me, you know, about Cindy, and I said, yeah, I'm terrible with meeting the women, but I go, this is so corny. I looked in her eyes, because I had the laser eye surgery done now, but I had fake contacts at the time, and I remember I had the blue contacts. So I looked at hers, and I have blue eyes anyway, but I looked at her, and I said, "Are those blue contacts?" And then I leaned in and gave her a kiss, and he just thought that was so funny. And of course, I had told Cindy about the fake eternity over the phone.
Uh-huh.
Well, the first time Russ met Cindy, he looked over at Cindy. He goes, "Hey, Cindy, are you wearing blue contacts?" And she laughed because she remembered me doing that, you know, a year or two earlier.
Uh-huh.
And without missing a beat, she leaned in and she goes, "Is that fake eternity?" And he laughed. So that became a running joke between the two of them. That whole week, Cindy was traveling with me, and wherever we'd go, you know, he'd have the waitress at the bar, or the bartender at the bar, give Cindy a drink and go, are you wearing blue contacts? And of course, Cindy would have the waitress take a drink to Russ, and sometimes even on stage going, "Is that fake eternity?"
Oh,
and it became a running joke. Well, anybody who's ever seen my shows knows that I rip up a newspaper and I put it back together.
Yeah.
And at the end of my show, I'll pick up a newspaper that the guy on stage rips up, but his doesn't come back together. But at the end of the show, I'll pick his paper up, and I throw that down, and his paper is back together. Well, I had actually had a paper printed up with an ad on it that said, "Russ Rivas wears fake eternity."
Really?
Yes. And that was the last night of the week. And these jokes just got bigger and bigger. I remember going to the room in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and we came back, and this is after the comedy club, some one-nighter hotel room, bar area. We came back in, and the 30 people in the bar, Russ had said, "When Cindy walks it back in, I want you guys to say, are you wearing blue contacts?" So in unison, 30 people, "Cindy, are you wearing blue contacts?"
Oh, my God.
Well, then the next night, I had this paper printed up, and I threw it down, and it says, "Russ Rivas wears fake eternity." I had, you know how you can get those ads,
sure,
in newspapers printed up and stuff like that. And he's in the back of the room going, "That's the winner right there. That's the winner."
Well, Russ is just hysterical, and his big thing is he likes a deal.
Yes.
He's, you know, I remember he got his first laptop, got this for $200.
Yeah.
Rick Dink came right off the truck.
Well,
okay.
Well, he's always said that to me. He goes, "Gail," he goes, "I got a deal for you. I know you like buffets." And so we'd stop at buffets. And, you know, another time, Cindy will hate me telling this story, but we were going, and Cindy goes, "Hey, Gail, I got to go to the bathroom real bad." And, first of all, I got gas at a gas station. I went into the men's room, and it stunk really bad. Russ was in there taking a crap.
Ah!
I go, "Russ, what the hell did you eat?" He goes, "Oh, sorry, Gail, man." You know, and anyway, then we get to the hotel, and Cindy says, "Hey, Gail, you got to let me off. I got to go to the bathroom." So I let her off at the hotel room, and I went and got some stuff. Well, she also made a smell, and I came into the room, and I go, "Oh, my God, Cindy, what did you eat?" I go, "This is worse than Russ Rivas's crap."
God.
And without missing a beep, the phone rings 30 seconds later, and it's Russ on the phone going, "Hey, what's wrong with my poop? What's wrong with my poop?" And I go, "Where the hell are you?" And he goes, "I'm right next to you. These walls are paper thin."
Rivas is great. And you don't do a good Russ Rivas impression. I'm sorry.
I'm terrible at it.
Because you're Russ Rivas. I say, "Dude. Do you know what it's like to have to sit in a room next to you with paper-thin walls, and then I hear that my shit stinks?"
Yeah.
See, that's a Russ Rivas right there, for those that are listening. Don't do a really good one. Doug McCraw does the best one.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Doug McCraw's the guy that started it.
He probably did, you know.
Yeah, because the Russ Rivas actually has to start "them fucking guys."
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
That's how it has to go. So anyway, no, it's good. And let me go back again. I want to ask you one other thing. You do one-nighters. Do you have trouble with hecklers?
You know what? I've always been good with hecklers. I usually bring them on stage and have fun with them. Once again, I don't let them take control of the show, but I have fun with them. And I've always done really well with them, you know, maybe because of the likability. Even if they're drunk. You know, one lady come up to me one time, and she's just drunk on stage, and she goes, "You're going to make an ass out of me, aren't you?" And I go, "No, you're doing a good job by yourself." And then she looks at me and she goes, this is before I was married, and she goes, I have a daughter. And I go, do you have a breath mint? That's all I care about right now. And, and actually the show was actually funny because of the quick – if you've
seen
my show
before.
Yeah, because
you're just going back and forth, sure.
I mean, you go to my website, and people can see, obviously, films and videos of every act, and people will see that my quick wit is probably what makes the show, is the interaction I have with the audience and just being quick-witted and having a sharp memory. But anyway, so I do pretty well with the hecklers, but you're right, the one-nighters are tough with hecklers sometimes.
Well, I want to know, what do you do with the guy that's yelling at how you do the trick? Because there are people who are students of magic.
Yeah.
And I imagine if they're going to really be mean,
they could yell at how it's done.
And they would say, yeah, well, look behind his blah, blah, blah. Or, where's your extra thumb?
Yeah, you know what?
Do you have that problem? Does that happen to you?
I'm trying to think. A couple times, maybe. But usually I'm a lot of the drunks, once you establish yourself, they don't want to mess with you anymore, But one time one guy goes, hey, I know how that trick's done. And I go, well, good, sir, you can go do it at home later tonight when you're by yourself. And then they'll shut up. But, yeah, I don't know. Not too often. I did have an experience at Wits End, though, that was funny. And I don't know if you know about this. This happened about 5 years ago. There was a drunk guy in the front row, late show, Friday night. Sometimes they work all week. They drink too much. And he was about 55 years old, had a lot of young girls around him. Every time I did a trick, Vilmos, he threw a $100 bill on the stage for me.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not. This happened at your club.
Oh, my God.
And I thought they were 20s. After my third trick in, and anybody who knows my show knows I only do 5 or 6 tricks in an hour's time. It's a lot of comedy, a lot of quick wit. I kind of make fun of myself a lot on stage. So it's not a lot of magic tricks. It's more comedy. Well, I thought to myself, I go, hey, sir, please take your 20s back. I don't want them. And the guy at his table goes, look at them. And I go, oh, my God, those are $100 bills. And he goes, I'm going to give you 100 for every trick you do. Well, now I'm thinking to myself, shit, I got to do 20 tricks. Well, and of course I go, I'm getting paid good. I don't need your money. And he goes, no. He goes, he picks up the $100 bill and rips it in half. He goes, you know how you ripped up your newspaper? I'm going to rip your $100 bill in half. And I go, no, sir. Here, let me give put these aside. I'll give them to you later. And he was definitely intoxicated.
Yeah.
Well, at the end of my show, I did the 5 tricks. There was $500 on stage. And at the end of my show, as I mentioned, I put that newspaper back together. I picked up the paper, and I also picked up the $500. And I go, folks, watch, 1, 2, 3. The paper's back together, and the $500 is gone. Good night, and take care. Yeah. And everybody laughed, and I looked at the guy, and I go, I'm kidding, sir. I will give you all your money back to you. Come talk to me at the back of the room.
Uh-huh.
Well, anybody who knows my show knows that I usually videotape the show, and then I sell DVDs of the show they just saw, which is a clean show. They can show it to their kids if they want to buy it, it's $20, and the postage and everything is included.
Yeah.
Anyway, his girlfriend comes up and she goes, he doesn't want his money back, but can we get a DVD? And I go, $500? You can get 25 DVDs.
Exactly. You've paid for one at least. You could have been an ass and go, yeah, that's $20 shipping and handling.
But you know what I did? I gave him 6 DVDs and basically, I mailed them 6 DVDs for all the people that were at their table.
That's hilarious.
And I felt so guilty because the waitress at the club that night only had gotten 20%, and she was kind of mad that I got her tips, so to speak.
Yeah.
But she still got her 20%. Mary Kay, God bless her, and Don, they said, Gail, how many times does the waitress split their tips with the comedians? And I'm going, hey, good point, never.
That's exactly right.
So you know what I did? I split my tips with the two comedians. I gave $100 to the MC and $100 to the feature.
Wow.
So that happened about 5 years ago. But I felt guilty. And then I did bring in a whole bunch of tacos for all the waitresses on Saturday night, and Don and Mary Kay. And I remember Mary Kay goes, oh, we like you. You bring food. Well, I felt guilty making extra money. You know what I mean? And so, anyway.
Well, we should never feel guilty for making people laugh and making money at it. And that brings us to the end of our show, folks. I mean, we've actually gone a little longer than we normally do. See?
Yeah,
doesn't
sorry about that.
Doesn't the time goes fast?
I talk fast.
But the time goes fast.
Yes, it does.
Everybody gets in here thinking, oh, God, 45 minutes, what? And it goes, just flies by. So, folks, I want to thank you guys for listening. I want to remind you about the shows. You can come see Gail. He's going to be here tomorrow, Thursday, the 13th of August, through Saturday, the 15th. And here's the show schedule. Thursday night, we have an 8 o'clock show, which is Military and College ID Night. If you fit into either one of those and you can prove it, you get in for free. Friday, we have 2 shows, 8 and 10:30. Saturday, we got a 5:30, 8 o'clock, and 10:30 show. You can get your tickets on the web. You can make reservations there at www.woodsendcomedyclub.com. Or if you want to do it the old-fashioned way, you can always call the phone, 303-430-4242. So, Gail, can't tell you how much we appreciate you coming to the Green Room and coming to work at Wits End.
Well, thanks for having me. It's one of the top clubs in the country, and I don't do as many clubs, but I always want to do yours at least once a year if I can. So thank you for having me.
We're glad to have you folks come and listen to come see Gail. And listen, like I always remind you, see your comedy live. That's the way you're supposed to do it. If you can't make it to Wits End, go to a comedy club near you. Thanks for listening.